This is File 30, Cycle 3. This is Jean McMillan. Today's date is April 11, 2018. I am interviewing resident state trooper Christopher Sorrell, who's going to talk about his career in police work. He's going to talk about his antecedents who were in police work and anything else he wants to discuss. But first, we'll start with his grandfather. Your grandfather came from Ireland?
It was actually my great-grandfather.
Oh, your great-grandfather.
So he was immigrated from Ireland, and his immigration paperwork, he listed himself as a constable. Constable being a law enforcement official. Mm-hmm. And then I have pictures of him and my great-uncle, along with others who were also all in law enforcement in the town of, in a small town in Berkshire County in Massachusetts.
You have an uncle Timothy?
That's actually my father, or that's my brother.
That's your brother?
Yes, and he's the chief of police in Lanesboro, Massachusetts.
I have a good friend that had many compliments for him.
Oh, boy.
It was really good. It was very good. You went into the Marines after school?
2 years. So I graduated high school in 1990. I was born and raised in up in Massachusetts in Berkshire County. Mm-hmm. And graduated in 1990. I did 2 years of community college. And then after that, I went in the Marine Corps from 1992 up till 1999. I was active duty.
Where were you stationed?
In Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, in Okinawa, Japan.
And what special training did you have?
As military police corrections, meaning I worked in a military prison.
As a police guard?
Or? Yes, so we're considered correctional officers, mm-hmm. or correctional specialists, I should say, in the Marine Corps. So, yeah, my job was to work within the military facility, the correctional facility. And part of that time was, on stateside, it was a, Camp Lejeune was one of the biggest, they call it brigs for the mm-hmm. military. Mm-hmm. So we had about 300 or so prisoners at any one time. And we had people that were for minor offenses, military offenses, up to, homicides, murders. And I worked in all different aspects within the squad bays, being large rooms where they're housed in mass, to special quarters, which was individual cells that were utilized for people because of the seriousness of the crime, or because of the, for punishment reasons, they're putting those in segregation cells. part of the time, my last year and a half, I spent in a correctional custody unit, which was separate from the brig, and what it was there was to take young Marines and sailors that had gotten in trouble, and we'd remotivate them through putting back in boot camp, and we ran physical training with them. They lived in open squad base. They'd work in parties during the day. We'd taught classes at night, and it was a way to remotivate these young Marines and sailors, taking them back into the fleet, to the Marine Corps and Navy, and be successful and successfully complete their enlistment time.
I see.
And that was up to 30 days they could be housed with us, and we literally broke large rocks to small rocks with sledgehammers during that time.
It works.
Yes. It
works. It
was very effective.
Offhand, would you know the percentage of success that you had with this program?
So that program, they had done a study at one point in time, and they were putting it around 70 to 80%.
That's a very good percentage.
It is very high. So it was a very effective program, and it had been utilized. When I was at Lejeune, it was being advertised heavily, and it was very effective at that point in time. And we'd hold, I'm trying to think of the max, I think it was 40 we could hold at a time of the 30 days. And we oftentimes had a waiting list. And they'd come as far away from Norfolk, Virginia, and I think Quantico was the other base that was pretty far away from Florida. So we're kind of within a couple hundred miles, they'd ship mm-hmm. people into us.
Good. It's very, very exciting. After you left the military, you went into police training, and that would be, what, 1999?
Yes, so December 1999, I came right from the military. So when I was in the Marine Corps, I processed for Connecticut State Police. I was then accepted, missed one class because my military obligation, was able to get out of the military early on my second enlistment, and was able to go start the academy in December of 1999. And the academy at that time was being held in Mansfield, Connecticut, mm-hmm. It's actually a minimum security prison that we had taken over, and we're using that for academy training.
Did you go into law enforcement because of your family background?
I think I'd always had an interest in it. So from the age of 14, I've been in an Explorer program, which is it's like an Explorer cadet or police cadet program.
Mm-hmm.
So from the age of 14, I've been involved with that up in the town of Lenox, Massachusetts. And doing that program, I was exposed to law enforcement, went to an academy every year that was a week long, and I worked with the police officers in that town. And then from that, I worked part-time during the summers as a traffic control officer for the towns up there because of the summer influx.
Oh, yes.
So in Stockbridge, the town of Stockbridge, I worked on Main Street.
Lucky
in
you.
So I actually did two summers, or actually probably more than that, but maybe three or four summers of running parking tickets and directing traffic during the summer days and for the Tanglewood concerts in Lenox. And then from that, I went to the Marine Corps, and then from the Marine Corps, I came here. So I'd always wanted, my ultimate goal was to be in law enforcement as either a state trooper or a local PD.
And the academy course that you took at Mansfield, how long did that last?
So the academy is 27 weeks, I believe, so roughly 7 months in length. And it's, you had to shave your head bald. It was very military-oriented,
mm-hmm.
plus...
Sure.
Academically, it was heavy in academics also.
It would have to be.
Yes. So you're taking people that, some have law enforcement experience and some have none.
Mm-hmm.
And so the program was set up so that, you'd learn everything you needed to know, whether you're prior law enforcement or new to law enforcement. So at the end, when you successfully make it through a program, you graduate and you get your badge, and then you go on to field training, which lasts for 30 working days after the academy.
And I notice you have a shoulder patch with pistols?
Yeah, so that's a TFC, so I'm a trooper first class. So what happens is when you graduate the academy, you're still considered a trooper trainee for the first 30 working days while you're doing the field training program.
Mm-hmm.
So once you graduate the field training program, then you're totally on your own. You're off and running and by yourself and fend off the sharks. So what happens is after 7 years of being a trooper from your first day in the academy, then you're automatically promoted or given the rank of trooper first class. So really it's more of a time in service. Everybody gets
it's a promotion, an automatic promotion.
It is a promotion, but it all it means is that you have 7 years
okay.
as a trooper. So in the whole scheme of things, so you can quickly look at somebody and say, well, he's got at least 7 years on the job.
Okay, it's like tenure for a teacher, 10 years on the job. That's about it.
In the whole scheme of things, it's no extra pay.
Extra
responsibility. It's just you're a trooper first class, and now you have something else to put on your uniform.
Oh, good.
So I don't know in the day if it was something different, but the promotion begins as a supervisor role. Really, is as sergeant, which is a test. You take a test, you do a oral board, and you do
written.
Yeah, written test, an oral board, and mm-hmm. Oral interview, and you do a resume. And then you're graded on all that, and then you're ranked by points, and then as they need sergeants, they start from the top of the list and work their way down. So that's,
there's a lot more to it than...
There is, but any position, like to become a resident trooper, to go to any specialized unit, usually there's an application process that's very similar to that. So I had a K-9 for 5 years. So when I had a K-9, besides doing an oral interview, you also did a physical fitness test, to make sure you met minimum standards for physical fitness.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was another 15-week academy with a K-9. So a lot of the positions, other than being on the road, once you go through the academy, if you want to go and do something different, whether it's work undercover in narcotics, or be a resident trooper, there's usually some kind of criteria you have to fulfill.
Oh, sure.
And there's some kind of testing process they're going to go through, mm-hmm. in order to pick somebody what they think is the best spot for the position, or the best person for the position that's open.
They have to match. They really have
Correct.
To match. When did you join Joint Troop B?
So I came out of the academy right to Troop B. So that would be in...
2000?
Yes, it would be roughly, I think, June 2000. So when I first came to Troop B, then as a new trooper... everything, you're the junior guy, meaning that, you get all the leftovers.
I know.
When controls are handed out, you get what nobody
yeah.
wants.
Yeah,
if there's
sure.
If there's something already pending, waiting for a call for a trooper to be sent to, that's going to require an investigation and a lot of work probably, that's where you're going to end up going first thing.
You get the leftovers.
Yes.
Okay. So,
and then it's by seniority. The senior guys get to pick where they want to go and what they want to do. You know, the desk is a trooper on the desk. It's usually the most senior trooper, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're the ones that are fielding the calls with along with the dispatcher and deciding who gets sent where. I mean, there's a criteria in place.
Yeah.
As far as when you're working the road, there's certain towns you're assigned to patrol. Troop B, just to clarify, covers 13 towns. It's roughly 500 square miles.
Yeah.
And it covers the towns of North Canaan, Salisbury, Goshen, Cornwall, Sharon, Winsted, any of the state property in Winsted, any state property in Torrington, the Route 8 Highway, Holbrook, Norfolk, Barkhamsted, Heartland. So it covers all of those towns.
But not Kent.
Nope. Kent is actually Troop L in Litchfield.
Oh, okay. Yes, I should know that. I should know that.
Even though Region 1 school.
Yeah, that's what
Kent,
I was...
Right,
yeah.
So, it's kind of, so we
But I should
those.
Know it was L. How long did you stay at Troop B before you wanted to become resident straight trooper?
So, as far as my tenure at Troop B, I was a K-9 officer or K-9 trooper.
From B?
Yes, yep. So
okay.
I was assigned at Troop B with a K-9. And then I went to Major Crime as a detective, Western District Major Crime. So for that time period when I was a detective for 2 years, technically you're not considered part of the barracks, you're considered part of Western District, which is covers from Bridgeport all the way up to Canaan. So the whole western quarter of the state or third of the state.
Okay.
For the state police purposes, the state's split into three regions or three areas. So we have Western District, which is the western half, mm-hmm. or third. Central District is the center of the state, say, yeah. from the Connecticut River straight down.
Yeah.
And then the eastern part is the far east side of the state. So it's kind of in thirds for the state police purposes.
Okay.
So Western District Major Crime covers from Bridgeport all the way up to Canaan. It's any major cases that come out of that area, and then you're assigned out of your office. And my office still happened to be at B, but I was not attached to Troop B anymore.
Okay.
So when I came back from that, I was a year at the high school, Regional 7. Region 1.
I'm going to get to that one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's perfectly
okay.
fine.
So,
It's called a little flashback.
Okay. So as far as, you know, the resident trooper program, I guess part of my decision-making process was that it's something I wanted to try, and everybody that did it seemed to enjoy it and like the program as a trooper. And at the same time, the barracks was going through a situation where we're trying to do consolidated dispatch.
Yeah.
So there was some fear of the unknown there that we didn't know what was going to happen, whether they were going to try and consolidate the barracks, meaning that you'd have to report at, say, a Troop L in Litchfield, and you could work, end up working at Southbury for the night, you could work wherever. We had no idea kind of what was going to happen. So I saw it as a way to control my destiny and control what's going to happen to me, knowing that, hey, if I'm in Salisbury, I'll be in Salisbury. I stay there. I don't have to worry about all this craziness that was going on at that time.
Smart man.
Because it was. It was something that they had tried in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
and they tried it for a period of time. I think it was less than a year, and then it failed. And it was the same kind of thing they're trying to put back in place and basing on technology saying that now it was going to work, which it didn't. So we went back to the system we currently have. Again,
it works.
We had prior. Right.
Yeah, you stick with what works. In order to become resident trooper, I'm assuming there's a process.
Correct.
What's the process?
So once the position had opened up, I think Mark Laurentano had been the previous resident
yep.
trooper. So he retired. They put a temporary resident trooper in here. It was Trooper Dave Collins. So when that opens up, then they open up a period where people can apply to put in for the resident trooper position.
Mm-hmm.
So you put in a resume, you put in your packet, whatever they require. It could be they could require a couple copies of reports that you wrote. It could require some of your police investigative skills to demonstrate that you're capable and can do the job assigned to you. And then, depending on how many people apply for it, then they do interviews. And then once the interviews are completed, then they pick the person that they think is came out the top of the pile, the cream of the crop, per se.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. And then you're assigned, then you're transferred to that position as a resident trooper, which
Do you enjoy being resident trooper in Salisbury?
I do.
Oh, good.
Yes, I do enjoy it. It's a lot of work.
Oh, sure.
I don't think people realize how much involvement you have with the community and how much you're kind of a jack of all trades. And, you know, you have to address everybody's situation or event that happens at that point in their life, whether it's a major event, you know, criminal-wise, or if it's very minor, to them it's a major event. And and they want to have it addressed or talked to or discussed with somebody. So you find yourself in the course of a day dealing with multiple issues, and some that really aren't police-related, but you still help them out and try to get them down the right path, and others that are definitely police-related and need to be dealt with accordingly.
I think one of my goals with the oral history is that the people that I interview can explain how complicated their jobs are so that people are aware of all of the effort that goes into whatever it is they're doing, whether it's tax collector, resident trooper, or anything. And nobody realizes how much work goes into something until they do it.
Correct.
Or have knowledge of. And that's why I do this, is so that the residents in the town understand how much goes into what you actually do, even though they don't see you except when they have an emergency of some sort. Do you offhand know when the resident trooper program began in Salisbury?
I could tell you even within the state, because I just looked it up a second ago, the Salisbury program, we're thinking it started in 1957. It appears to be, was the first one was Stan Sedgwell,
mm-hmm.
was the first resident trooper. And the program for the state actually started in 1947. And the state police was formed in 1903, just to back up the history.
Yeah, I was looking at your shoulder patch.
So actually, I just got the text now. So he started his duties in November 1 of 1957 for the town of Salisbury.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Because I came in 67, and I had one of Stan's kids in my class.
So at that time, the resident trooper, you had to live in the town.
Yeah, he did.
You had to have a sign in front of your house.
He did.
You had to have a phone in your house. Yep. You had your phone listed to the public, and you had to have an office in your house.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a $50 stipend a month to offset the cost of those within your residence.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, how nifty. How nifty. Oh, good. These are all sorts of things that nobody knows until we find out.
Right. So the program, it morphed since then. There is a resident trooper stipend still, but I don't have to live in town, and I don't have to have people going to my house and knocking at my door and calling my house.
Yeah, that can be an annoyance. Try being a school teacher. I understand. All righty. You were a resource officer at the high school.
Correct.
How many years?
For 1 year. So that was actually like... So it looks like 2008 to 2009.
What were your responsibilities?
So in the high school, you're assigned as a school resource officer, and just assisting, like, mainly the administration, the principal, vice principal, with addressing any issues in the school. And not so much, you're not dealing with kids in the halls that don't have a pass. I mean, you can address those, but the reality was to be there for any issues involving, the students, whether it was the same type of scenario. You have a kid that maybe is disruptive in school to the point where it's becoming, a criminal type of situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you would address that accordingly. Sometimes it was just talking to kids and kind of informing them. At that point in time, too, was a big license change for driver's licenses.
Oh, yes.
Where the junior operators, the ones that were 16, 17 years of age, had all the stipulations for 3 months. They couldn't have passengers. They had curfews.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that, my time was spent kind of letting the students know they had licenses, what the rules were.
Good.
So that they would hopefully keep themselves out of trouble.
Yeah.
So I did give our classes assisted in classes when it came to law enforcement matters, such as some of the laws. We did some other events within the school to help kids kind of understand what law enforcement is about. And, so a lot of the kids, it was busy, anything. It's, you don't realize how busy it is until you get there and you start dealing with it. So for the most part, I think it was very positive, and a lot of the staff were very happy with the program when we had it in place. And the students, likewise, were very happy with it.
Yeah, the students would be, I think, because it was a way of informally understanding what the police do, and if they had an issue, they felt comfortable coming to see you, because they knew who you were.
Correct.
It makes a difference. It truly does. Were you ever in the elementary schools?
And during that time, no. So when I was at SRO, I was just assigned to Region 1, to the high school.
Mm-hmm.
And so my main focus was to be in the school, Monday through Friday once, class was going on. So, I mean, our schedule still is what our schedule is as far as the hours I work, but it, so I was, came on duty before school started. I was still on duty when it ended. But, it was just like any other school, you're trying to address, the issues going on, bullying issues, or any social issues that you can address, you know, from your standpoint. Mm-hmm. Plus, if there's drug activity in the school, you'd address that. If you saw something that, you know, didn't quite fit in, or there's some concern about certain students and what they're up to. So, like I said, it was very busy. It always seemed to be something.
Oh, sure. Oh, there always is with kids.
So, I thought at the time the vice principal was Miriam Buchanan, and the principal was Gretchen Foster, I believe. And they had a good hand, knowledge of what was going on within the school, what students were doing what, and who, kind of hang out with, who hung out with who.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You need to know that.
So it was very informative, and, we tried to address issues before they became issues. You know, if we knew there was a gathering going on, or there was going to be some kind of event where kids could be put in a position where they're probably going to get themselves in trouble or something, not appropriate was going to happen, we tried to address that ahead of time.
How about proms? Prom night, that sort of thing. Were you on duty for that, or?
I'm trying to think how we did that at the time. I know we did. I did the sporting events. I remember doing basketball games, hockey games, and stuff like that. So the way it worked out for us was, if I was assigned to the school at any after school activities that they wanted law enforcement present at, mm-hmm. I would be the one assigned to them. So, like, I'll say Turkey Bowl when they do that, the Thanksgiving mm-hmm. game, the traditional game. I was there for that. Basketball games, like I said, hockey, and I can't remember off the top of my head if we did anything with the prom or not, or if it was in a different town.
It may have been different.
It might have been in a different town, if it was a town with a local PD, like in Winsted or over yeah. It might have even been in New York State, so we'd let them deal with that, the prom being held out of state.
Who was the vice principal then? I didn't get
Marianne Buchanan. She's actually, I think, one of the principals now in Torrington. I think her last name was like a B-U-C-H. Mm.
I've been out for 27 years, so I've lost touch. How has school security changed over the years, particularly since Sandy Hook?
So, I would say that for law enforcement purposes and a lot of the schools, Columbine was a big event, culminating event, and that happened in the late 90s. So after that, for law enforcement, our tactics changed. I think the school started really looking at the threat of an active shooter, active aggressor. Mm-hmm. So a lot of schools did update their security, but there's many schools, I won't name them locally, but that chose to really not to do much of anything because, the mentality was it's a small town, it's never going to happen here.
Oh, yes, it is.
So then fast forward to Sandy Hook. Sandy Hook happens. Immediately after Sandy Hook, then there's a huge huge issue with school security. So any schools that did not have, the remote access doors already in place, it was definitely a scramble to immediately put those in place. The schools that felt, were in a small town, nothing would ever happen, were definitely changing their ways and the way they dealt with things. So Sandy Hook was a huge change for school security as far as that went. And it also was there's a lot of influx after that with SROs in schools that did not have.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The program for the state police, the SRO program for, like, specifically Region 1, was stopped prior to Sandy Hook, and that was mainly because it was a program that's put in place initially when I got hired in 99 under a COPS program. It was a federal grant when they hired approximately 200 troopers at one, for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. So once that grant was over and done with, the troopers initially stayed in the school as SROs, but at some point in time, one of our leadership or people in command saw these troopers in schools and realized that we really need more troopers on the road, in their opinion.
So they were moved.
So they were pulled out of the schools and put back on the road. So that's how Region 1 lost their trooper. So if a regional high school wants one now, they'd have to pay the state in order to have it there, have a trooper assigned, much like the resident trooper program.
I see. Well, I know at Salisbury Central now. I worked in both buildings, and I worked there for 24 years. Now, there's only one door that's unlocked. You have to be buzzed in. You have
Correct.
To wear a name tag.
Yep.
And I get a kick out of it because all of the secretaries I had in my fourth grade, but I mm-hmm. still have to be buzzed in, and
yes.
I have to have a name tag. And it's like,
yeah.
But it's important.
It is
important. You have to save the kids.
Yes. So I think, the reality was after, for the Connecticut, Sandy Hook was probably the third mass shooting we had. We had the Connecticut lottery that occurred before I came on. The beer distributors out in West Hartford, East Hartford, I think it was. There was an active shooter event out there, and then of course Sandy Hook. Mm-hmm. So you know, Connecticut itself has been struck by this three separate occasions. So, and then backing up further, the 9/11 attacks, the first 9/11 attacks with a truck bomb, those individuals actually trained in Connecticut setting off explosives prior to them trying to take down the World Trade Center with the truck bomb. So Connecticut unfortunately is stuck between two major cities. And
we're a training ground for a lot of this stuff. So,
now, as resident trooper, do you take care of all of Salisbury?
Yep. Yeah, so whether it's Taconic, Amesville, Lime Rock, it's for state purposes and for my purpose, it's just Salisbury. So, yeah. So
how about Mount Riga?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, that's fun. That's a fun area.
So, yeah. So anything within the borders of Salisbury, whether it's called Lime Rock, Taconic, or Amesville, whatever, Mount Riga, however you want to name it, still for
it's
us.
It's all. Yes. And how big is Salisbury? About 40 square miles? Oh, now we're going to use some technology. Oh, he's got a little book.
I'll tell you. That's a good question. I forgot. And I knew it, too, because I've been quizzed on this before. But total 60.65 square miles.
It's a big area.
It is. And so 86 miles of roadway, with 52 of those being actually town-owned. And the population is 3,741 as of 2010 census.
Well, I will have done 360 oral history, so I've got most of the town. I asked you about a job description, and you just kind of threw up your hands, rolled your eyes, and said, but I do everything, which is a pretty good description. You do everything.
So I think ultimately, you just have to always be open to, literally right before our meeting today, I was sent to a 911 hang-up or 911 call because somebody locked themselves out of their house and couldn't figure out how to get back in their house.
You break a window.
Well, actually, it was easier than that.
Oh, good.
So it was a rental property. They're from, actually from China, the people. And they had locked the door, and they couldn't get the key to work in the door they'd locked. So I took the key, tried it when it worked, checked some windows, tried the back door of the key, and the key worked in the back door. So it was a very easy resolution.
Smart man. Oh, yeah.
But it is not uncommon for us to have to try to force entry into the homes or assist somebody with doing that. So it's, call to call, you never know. You can do some calls can be very police specific. Somebody, broke into a house, they stole items, and it's a burglary, larceny.
Yeah, I've had that happen twice.
Oh, so, unfortunately.
Well.
And other times you get called to things where it's kind of, you get there and you're kind of thinking, okay, how can I resolve this, the best way possible for this person, this system, in the matter.
You have to be very creative and very flexible.
Yes. So, and she even tried to give me a tip, which I explained to her in the United States.
That you don't.
We have law enforcement that we don't receive tips, and, you don't have to do that here. But in her country, where she's a native country, they do take tips. So.
Oh, yeah.
So it's, sometimes it's education, of educating people.
Oh, yes.
It's a whole gamut. I mean, we've had, the bank robber, of course, that was on the front page of the paper that we had in town there. I captured, on 44. I mean, we've had home invasions, burglaries, larcenies.
Been there, done that,
So it's a whole gamut of things, simple larcenies, motor vehicle accidents, speeding vehicles. So everybody, any citizen has their own, lack of better words, pet peeve. Some residents get very upset with motor vehicle traffic on their roadway, like big trucks. Some people don't like all the trucks that come through town. But, you can't stop a truck because they're just driving through Main Street and they're doing their route to go, wherever they're going with their trailer truck.
Yeah.
You try to appease everybody to some extent.
It's pretty hard. It's pretty hard. It's a hard job.
It is. And you try to, among with everything else that's going on, you try to always... Twin Lakes during the summertime is another...
Oh, yeah.
So we do have three constables that work, under me. Mm-hmm. They're all certified police officers.
Are they the Marine...
Marine Patrol, yep. So we have a boat for Twin Lakes, a police boat, and then they go on patrol mainly on the weekends. We try to focus, and their job out there is to enforce boating laws. So much like motor vehicle laws, there's certain laws of boating, and if you you know, violate those laws, either get a written warning, a verbal warning, or you can receive a ticket, you know, a mail infraction. So yep. Their job is to, you know, make sure we're being safe, responsible boaters on Twin Lakes.
Howard O'Dell used to do that.
Yeah, so he was originally a constable, uh-huh. You know, full police power yep. initially. And then when I took over, he'd already become, they called it, I think they're calling it Lake Auxiliary. Under the statute, there's a obscure thing where you could give somebody some limited powers, which he had at that point.
He was called what?
Lake? It was a Lake Auxiliary.
Okay.
And so they, under DEP, the Environmental Department yep. of Environmental Protection, there was a statute that allowed him to go on the lake and enforce. It was kind of weird in a way because it talked about, like, he could enforce, like, stolen boat motors and stolen motorboat, you know, the hulls of the boat. But then, you know, then he couldn't give out tickets. It was very odd, you know, how it was written. But at any rate, so he did that. He did that until he'd suffered a mild stroke.
Yes, yes.
And actually, I had him. It was a motor vehicle accident. He had gotten a motor vehicle accident on Route 112, and that's when I saw the obvious signs of a stroke. And, mm-hmm. and after that, was he had, a blood clot. So that was the last year, was that year that he did the boat patrol. And then I hired two more retired police officers to come on to assist in the lake patrol so we could have a full staffing and try to cover on every weekend.
Do you do the same for Lake Winnanskapamic?
No. No, on because that lake is restricted.
Okay.
Of the horsepower.
Yep, so, it would be.
And it's controlled by pretty much by the boat launch at the Grove itself.
Right.
So that's not an issue. Twin Lakes, you know, is the public.
More open. It's public.
Right, so you have up to 35 miles an hour. They can travel all. You have water skiing, tubing, and, you know, so there is a speed limit, but like Long Pond, for instance, mm-hmm. There is no speed limit. So you could technically go on Long Pond and take a boat and go over 35 miles an hour and
yeah.
be in violation of anything. And we don't patrol that. The only lake we patrol is Twin Lakes. That's where our boat is actually housed there during the summer months.
Then you wouldn't do Riga Lake either.
No, and they do their own.
They do their own patrol.
Right?
They have
their yeah. Danny Breezy, I think, is the park ranger now. Young Danny.
Young Danny.
So he's up there.
Yeah, okay. You have to be careful. There's Brazies and Brazies and Brazies, and it's Young
right.
Dan.
Yeah, so.
I didn't have him. I had other Brazies, but I didn't have him. As resident state trooper, how long can you stay? Are there term limits?
Nope.
You can stay as long as you want?
I can stay until hypothetically, I could retire here, or I could, you know, pull the plug and go one day. Or, you know, worst case scenario, if the town was unhappy with what I was doing, they could eliminate the program altogether. Or they could just, you know, say, maybe we're not, you know, the resident trooper is not, you know, getting along with the town, you know, fathers. So, you know, it's not a good mix. So maybe, you know, step down. So ultimately, it's, I can stay here until I decide to leave or something adverse would happen.
Are you accountable to the selectmen?
Yes and no.
No. Okay,
so
yeah.
Ultimately, my chain of command is through the barracks at Troop B
right.
in North Canton. So as part of the resident trooper program, though, my daily business usually is I always try to talk to the selectman at least once a day to kind of give him a heads up what's going on, if he's got any issues he wants to address with me. So there's a, you know...
There's a give and take.
Correct. So
okay.
He's not technically in charge of me because I'm in, you know...
You're an independent from the barracks.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Correct. So I do have a sergeant supervisor that's over me, but ultimately if the selectman said... Which happens, you know, we have Main Street, there's people complain about the crosswalk violations, there's too much, you know, speeding vehicles,
mm-hmm.
So then I make it a point to go out there and be visible, put the speed limit signs out, try to slow people down, make them aware of what's going on.
Okay.
So if there's issues that need to address, or if there's a question he has about legality that could help him out with law enforcement-wise, then I'll address that issue. So, yeah, there is definitely, you know, ultimately, I'm here because the town wants me here in order to help the town out.
Sure.
So I think, you know... No matter how you cut it, you have to be personal and approachable in order to...
Oh, absolutely. Now you do. Early on, they didn't have to be, but...
Right, I think the
times have changed.
Correct, you know, and mainly I think because the cost of the program now is more different than it was. It's slowly flipped sides, so now the towns are playing a substantially more part of the program than they had in the past, so...
Now, I asked you before how is best to solve crime, whether it's technology or talking to people, and... I loved your answer.
The old-fashioned talking to people.
Yeah.
Foot leather.
Yeah.
You know, shoe leather. That's what it comes down to. As we say, so at the barracks, historically at the barracks, years ago they had a chef. They'd have a mechanic, and everything was out of the barracks. Mm-hmm. So to this day, we still have roll call, meaning that before...
I remember that.
So at the beginning of your shift, you go to the barracks, and you all meet, and you sit at the kitchen table early, and you talk about kind of what's going on in there, mm-hmm. and you have a book that people put entries in. So, you know, we had a situation one time where somebody reported a wallet missing to me, and then another individual at the table had another case in another part of the patrol area regarding some fraudulent credit card, and we kind of, sitting there, we talked about the case, realized, hey, wait, these are related. And so we actually, by talking, once again, we quickly solved the case, like, right there. And I alluded to you in the past, too, here, that there's cases where you do a neighbor canvas, you call it. So whenever somebody's, you know, somebody's house gets broken into, you talk to all the neighbors to see if they saw anything unusual. Mm-hmm. And so on more than one occasion now, I've had it where I've talked to neighbors, and neighbors says, well, you know, there was this situation. I saw this guy walking. Mm-hmm. This person stopped in. I saw this vehicle. Seemed odd, but I didn't think much of it at the time. And so I truly believe that's the way to solve crime. Yeah. The technology is there, but, you know, people know, you know, they wear gloves. They wear socks on their hands or whatever to cover the fingerprints. There is DNA. It's very expensive. If you don't have someone's DNA in the database, then that's great. You have it, but you got to have somebody to match it too.
Sure.
So
sure.
I still definitely believe in talking to people. And in a town like this, and the other benefit of the program is that you kind of know who's doing what.
Oh, yeah.
So when something happens, in one case specifically, I had an individual that I was seen walking. His house is at one location. A garage is broken into, some power tools were taken, chainsaws. The house after that, we'll say a lady had seen an individual walking, described him to me, which he's a larger male, walking with a very tiny dog. Or no, he claimed he was looking for his dog. But I found it very odd because in the past he's a known drug user, he's a known thief. And lo and behold, he was the one who broke in the garage and sold the chainsaws. And it was a good, you know, neighbor who said, you know, it seemed a little out of place, but, you know, this is what he told me. And his story quickly fell apart when we talked to his family members and said the dog's never been missing. So there's no reason to be out looking for it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think ultimately it's you know, the old-fashioned police work. You go out and talk to people.
Good.
And you know, networking's a big thing. Mm-hmm. You talk to other departments. Mm-hmm. Here, it's unique because we have Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York all mixed together. And the borders, as you know, are just lines on a map.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, so people come here, steal stuff, go to New York, stay, and get rid of it, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So you have to have contacts in other states. As quickly call them up and say, hey, do you have something similar to this? Once in a while, we have meetings where we all get together, and you just talk. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you realize, like, wait a second. This sounds really similar. I think I know who this is.
Yeah.
And you kind of put things together. So it ends up working out. You know, the bottom line is just communication, talking to people, getting it out, to get the information out there.
It's good to have you say that. I'm very impressed because there's so much talk about technology, this, technology, that. But it's basically talking to people. And people do observe what's going on.
They do. They see stuff, and they may not know what they see, but they just know it's not normal for their mm-hmm. area. And they know, some people, you know, you see, like, drug dealing going on. So they see the car, they see it stop for a minute or two at a house, and they see it leave, and they say, well, that's odd behavior. And then they see another car.
Yeah.
They see it in a parking lot, and they approach you and say, hey, I saw this the other day, and I'm kind of thinking...
It doesn't feel right.
Right, and I said, no, what you saw probably is a transaction for narcotics. Mm-hmm. And they said, that's what I was thinking I was seeing.
Yeah.
And that's come in handy where somebody... Yeah, give me information like that, described a vehicle to me, and I knew right away who it was.
Sure.
And within a period after that, we actually had stopped him and found him with over 100 bags of heroin. So, and that was really stemmed from people just saying, hey, I saw this, it didn't seem right, and I just want to let you guys know, and here we are.
And that's important. What do you like best about your job?
I think, for me, is, I like solving cases. I like... Like when somebody, you know, like someone's had something taken or something happened to somebody, you can't take it away, you can't make it right necessarily, but you can make it right or kind of fill in the gaps by arresting the person that's responsible, kind of closing the case out. So, you know, if you have a house that's broken into, it's very, you know, as unfortunately you're aware, but it's very personal. That's your personal space.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very much a personal thing, and you do feel violated.
So to me, it's like, hey, I like to go out there. You know, you get that case, you solve it, resolve it, and say, okay, we found out who's responsible, we arrested them for, you know, sometimes you get the items back, oftentimes you can't because they're disposed of, they're gone. Yeah. But it's, you somewhat make that person whole again and saying, okay, you know, you can kind of put the pieces back together a little bit. So that's what, you know, that's one of the benefits of law enforcement. I like to do them, is that the ability to kind of make things right as best you can in the situation. I look at cases like, okay, if this is my family member and it happened to him, how would I want to address and handle it?
Yeah.
You know, and I think as a resident trooper, you find you take it very personal, like if something happens.
It's your town.
Right.
You've got to protect your town.
So you feel like, hey, you know, I got to go above and beyond. And yeah. I really want to find out who did this and take it, you know, and get the resolution I need out of this. Because, you know, it's frustrating at times. You know, if you keep, and there's cases out there. I'm not 100% solve rate. I have a good solve rate, but not 100%. But it's, I think statistically, if you look at, like, burglaries and residents, you know, nationwide, it's probably like a 20% solve rate. In towns like a resident trooper town, the other trooper that just retired out of North Kent, I mean, our solve rates are around probably 80%, so it's much different. We actually worked together well before he retired, and we had a case where we had about 20 houses broken into in the area, and we were able to arrest both individuals responsible. So, you know, and that's a huge resolution right there when you have 20 different houses, 20 different victims, that you can kind of say, hey, this is what happened, we know who did it, and they're being held accountable for. And, you know, and some of the stuff
that's comforting.
We got some stuff back, you know, and some stuff was gone, you know, but when you go to Waterbury to the pawn shops and you come back with a Jeep full of stolen items, you know, and you can at least make some people feel better they got their stuff back and kind of put things back in place for them.
That makes a great deal of difference. So. That does. Before we close, is there anything that you'd like to add that I haven't covered?
So we talked about, I just want to recognize some of the people that have done the program here in Salisbury, some of the names.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a list together. I ran to Charlie Ouellette the other day. I think it's Ouellette, the way you pronounce it, Pat. So some of the names that we had was, in. So starting off with the first resident trooper was Stan Sedgwell.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been, I had that diary for you, that was 1957. And then it went Bob Smithwick, who also passed away. Charlie Ouellette.
When did Bob, do you know when Bob started?
I don't have all the years. Okay. These were the list off of Charlie Ouellette, who works at the town doing the weed harvester now.
Yeah.
I ran to him here and I said, hey, by the way, while you're here, I said, you know, I just want to run something by you. So so we had Bob Smithwick, we had Charlie Ouellette, and he said he did about 12 years here.
Yeah, he did.
And then he was injured at one point in time, so there's a little bit of a gap, but overall it was like about 12 years. Dean Hammond at the time was also here. I think there's two of them at that point in time.
Oh, yeah, I had his kids too.
Lonnie Mull.
No, that one, I think I'd left by that time.
So he was kind of a little bit of a short-termer in between there.
Yeah.
He actually just retired after roughly 40 years of being a trooper. Mark Laurentano.
Yep, remember him.
Jim Bettini was a fill-in. I think Mark had went back in the Marine Corps.
How do you spell Bettini?
I think it's Bettini.
That sounds right.
So he was here when Mark had gone back in the Marine Corps.
Okay, I've got Mark's Vita that he did when he was running for first selectman.
So that's Jim Bettini.
It's in there.
And then after Jim Bettini was John Sipper.
John
Sipper, it's S-I-P-P-E-R.
And now you.
More between me, surprisingly. Oh. Pat Malloy, or Patrick Malloy, M-A-L-L-O-Y. And then it was back to Mark Lawrence. Mark Laurentano came back after Pat Malloy for a second tenure. There's a gap there.
That I didn't realize.
And I think that was a whole different story. But Dave Collins was here temporarily after Mark retired, and then I came here in 2011.
Wonderful. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome, and I think that's it.
That's it.